Good afternoon and welcome to Digging Deep on WDRT Community Radio, coming to you from the Driftless area. Our studios are in Viroqua, Wisconsin, and we're also available on the internet at WDRT.org, where you can go and listen at any time to the current program or previous podcasts, WDRT.org. We're at 91.9 FM and streaming live. So, this is a kind of an offshoot of my food show, which is Who's in the Kitchen. And we decided a few years ago that we really needed a farming show. So this has got, you know, we can go to all kinds of topics. And my guest today is Lars Bergen. Welcome, Lars.
Hi, Philothea.
And we kind of invent what we're going to do about farming. But Lars has been in a farming family for a long time and has his own farm near Bloomingdale. And he's been on my show a number of times. He's a great cook, founder of the Driftless Cafe, actually. Right? How many years ago?
About 20 plus.
Oh, my gosh. I can't believe it. Yeah. And so sometimes I don't give him credit for that. But he's been a teacher for years at Youth Initiative High School. And he's also just loving his piece of land and things that you can do on it. I'd like to do maybe a show on just what do you do with a piece of land if you don't want to grow corn and soybeans, because there is so much you can do. If you have an acre, 5 acres, 20 acres, there's a lot of things you could do. So we're going to pick up where we left off, because Lars reminded me that we did herding and hunting and didn't really get to the recipes last time we talked.
Yes, and that was on Who's in the Kitchen.
That was
your sister program.
Right, and I just felt like farming is so connected to the food.
Absolutely.
How can you not know what's going on with farming?
That was actually, you know, you mentioned the Driftless Cafe. That was kind of what the impetus of starting it almost was, that I was teaching gardening at the Youth Initiative High School, and we were really outperforming in how much we were producing, and I was like, dang, one should have a restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And so... And I think the question of, yeah, what do you do with a piece of land is so, it's such a full, rich question. And I recently did have a pasture walk at our place. I was, Value Stewardship Network asked me if I would, and I had done several of them. And it's already happened now. And so I can share the lessons that I learned in doing it. And the most interesting thing is, like, generally these pasture walks are focused on some sort of technical innovation that a farmer is doing that he can share with other farmers, you know, a new way of doing something,
right,
or a different thing to do.
And I've been interested in going on some of these pasture walks because I'm kind of, you know, switching what my emphasis is on my land. I've got 40 acres, mostly woods, about 15 tillable. But yeah, I mean, who can go on a pasture walk? Well, if you want technical information.
Well,
but
anybody can go.
Anybody can go.
But because I've probably done, like, maybe this is maybe my fifth. And they're always billed as something like, oh, you know, how do you set up your paddocks, or how do you do a rotational grazing cow-calf operation? But when they asked me for a title or a theme this time, I was like, you know, how about farming for beauty?
Beauty.
Beauty is a very provocative word, actually.
Mm.
You know, because everyone's theoretically in favor of beauty, right? Like, it's a positive thing. You want things to be beautiful. But it also does involve a certain amount of discernment. You know, you have to decide what you think is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, and so in putting that out there, it really made me kind of reflect on what we're doing at our place and mm-hmm. why, because that is the principle. That in saying it, I recognize our principle as a farm, 115 acres, half of it, you know, open enough to graze or to drive a tractor on. And we've mainly managed it using cattle that are rotationally grazed, meaning that you're moving them during the growing season, or even out of the growing season, you know, daily or every couple days, so that principle being that almost all of your ground's always covered by growing things, and 95% of it on any given day is also not being eaten by cattle, so that it's growing, it's actually growing, so that it gives your grasses a chance to regenerate and recover. And there's people like my friend Peter Allen who can tell this story much better, but here I am telling it, so I'll tell it as well as I can. But you're mimicking the processes that built the soil in the world, which is that you have a group of animals, whether it's 10 or 10,000, that are being kept in a tight formation by something. In nature, it would be a predatory pressure, like wolves or animals that would keep that herd in a tight bunch. On a farm, on a modern farm, it's fence, you know, so we move fence regularly to create these limited spaces for the cattle to thrive on. Because if you give the cattle the whole pasture, what you get is eventually something that's eaten down to the height of a golf course green, and then some thistles, and then some rocks. You know, like it's, if left to just spread out to the edges, cattle will eventually really damage a piece of land. But if they're kept in a tight group and moved around, well, they benefit it. They raise the carbon level, and they also provide food for people. So anyway, in getting ready for this pasture walk, it made me think of, like, what is beauty? You know, what really is beauty? And one principle that we have definitely worked with, Karina, my wife and I, and my son Henry, and other son Elliot, is that nature is the most beautiful. Like, God created the world perfect, you know, and that so many human structures that are meant to control nature really just wind up being ugly things that you have to maintain, that you have to mow around. And so we've, on our place, we've really striven to have the buildings be right size to the environment, and that we really discuss a lot of times before we add another building, because buildings are depreciating assets. Yeah, they can protect your car or give you a place to do some work or give you a place to sleep out of the weather. But unlike the rest of a well-managed farm, they're slowly falling apart, no matter how well built. Like, and so to create beauty, you mainly want to let nature show her face. Like, let nature express herself. And that can be everything from, you know, a 300-year-old white oak tree to a 20-foot tall ragweed. You know, it just depends. But basically, the interaction between the sun and the earth and the carbon dioxide in the air produces a fantastic amount of life and activity. And a beautiful farm, we think, should be showcasing all of those things.
So are you kind of managing this wild stuff? I mean, pruning,
yes,
or
pruning,
giving,
cutting,
mowing, so
once
that you
in a
get
while.
Kind of a, you know, a
right
foundation and, or something. I mean, my farm just does not look that beautiful, and I'm just having to mow a whole bunch of thistles right now, and I'm thinking they're not. They were very pretty when they were purple, and now they have gone. They're
fluffy.
Going to seed, and you got to maintain them, and nobody wants to eat them, do they? Well, I think goats might.
Yes, goats pigs will eat them.
Pigs will eat thistles?
Yeah. In a really funny kind of side mouth way, but they will eat them. So I put this title out there. We were thinking about it. And the other thing that was cool about this is, because we were talking about beauty and, like, diversity, I think, is a big part of beauty. The same endless repetitions of the same thing, that's not beautiful. It can't be. It's too boring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's machine. It's like, it's...
Well, that's what's so beautiful about driving around here, because even the farmers that are growing the conventional crops, they're doing them in strips and rows and contours, which are beautiful.
Right.
And but if it was just, you know, a nonstop corn or whatever for 200 acres or something, that would be monotonous, right?
Yes, and I travel a lot for my work around the upper Midwest, and you do really notice that the Driftless Cafe, I mean the Driftless region, is it's a refuge from a lot of things, including it's a refuge from monotony, because you can certainly drive from Rockford to like Bloomington, Illinois, and really see just about nothing but corn and beans and grain dryers. And you go back a couple hundred years, and it was that hundreds of species of animals and plants all around you all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to see that as being progress. But anyway, so I put this I put this advertisement out, and I also, the Valley Stewardship Network hooked me up with Sky Bruce, who's a PhD entomologist.
Right.
And she was there to, like, discuss the, you know, she had written her dissertation on the effects of rotational grazing on insect populations, butterflies specifically. And the short conclusion was that rotational grazed pastures have twice as many butterflies as conventionally grazed pastures.
Oh, really?
But also, just, it was another way of looking at a farm that, like, you think you're farming beef, or you think you're farming corn, or whatever it is you say you're farming, but you're actually farming everything. You're farming deer, you're farming weeds, you're farming insects. All of that is part of what you're doing. So I put this out there. You know, we kind of prepared for 20 or 30 people, because that's what we usually prepare for. But I was like, we also offered lunch, which is that we were going to cook. So that, it's like, well, whenever I'm cooking for more than just like a set guest list, I cook for about 100, because you just don't know who's going to come. And dang, after we got 100 people show up. And the only difference about this compared to the other pasture walks that we've done is that we talked about beauty. And not only was it a lot more people that came, but it was a really big variety of people, from like large, like, you know, cash grain landholder sort of people, all the way down to people with an acre or two.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
because I didn't do a poll, but I did have a lot of conversations that word beauty really opens up people's minds.
No.
To like, because that's why most of us move to the country.
Well, I was thinking, why do people move to the country?
It's for beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And but yet so easily you can lose track of that once you're there, because you're like, oh, we need a driveway. Oh, we need a well. Oh, we need a house. Oh, we need our farm to make money. All these things are important. But if you moved to the country for the beauty, that should be your meditation. That should be your your real focus. It's like, is this step we're going to take, putting up this fence, putting up this building, driving, you know, flattening this area, is it going to make it more beautiful? Is it going to make it a better place to live for me and these other creatures?
I certainly felt that when I visited your farm. I just thought there were just some really lovely touches that you just thought about, where people would walk, where people would rest, where people would go out more into the wilder part of the farm. It's very sweet how you've planned that.
And so what I learned from that is that we modern humans just spend a lot of time talking about efficiency and money and time and how we're using those things. But none of those things really access the deep yearning that we have, like the way we want to be here on Earth. And so it kind of takes me back to the topic of that Henry and I were speaking last time, this notion of herding versus hunting. And because Henry didn't come today, I can also talk about him a little bit, because it's an interesting thing. Like, the boy is a really wonderful hunter and fantastic woodsman.
And what age is he now?
He's 11.
Okay.
And he's can identify all the trees in the forest. He's a crack shot with any rifle you give him. And anytime I suggest any kind of outdoor experience, from going to the Boundary Waters to just walking in our own woods, He's always up for it. Anytime I suggest that he help me with a farm project, like mowing, fixing the tractor, pretty reluctant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just really an interesting thing to observe that's a true expression of human desire. He knows that we need to do a certain amount of farming and fixing for us to subsist mm-hmm. on our property, and so he'll do it, you know, but it's never something he's excited to do. But
well, I think some people do come out to the land and they just don't realize how much equipment you have to make it look nice or just keep it under control. And some farmers will say, you know, farming is, you know, 75% machinery repair. You're just always repairing, repairing, repairing. And that isn't really so much fun for guys or women
No.
or whatever. But there is, yeah.
All those things are choices. And that's uh-huh. and if you imagine, you know, the kind of farming that the native people were doing here before Europeans came, they were very much managing the land. They were managing it with fire mm-hmm. primarily. Uh-huh. That's a topic that we'll get to a little later here.
Okay.
By burning those prairies, they did several things. They got rid of last year's undergrowth. They controlled tree incursion, so they kept the land open. And they created a spot that would have especially delicious forage because it's totally tender and young. And again, I'm going to quote Peter Allen, that is the spot where the forage is going to be the best after you've burned because of the amount of nutrients that are kind of, I guess, intensified or concentrated by the fire. So,
wow.
And like looking back a little bit in time, thinking about how humans have related to fire is really interesting because we know like sometime they just discovered in England. They've pushed the domestication of fire way further back by 100,000 years. They found a site where people were burning things on purpose.
Oh.
So, because of course the thing that they teach in history class, I even taught it in error as a history teacher, is that like all these technologies that are pretty recent, like fire, and that there's sort of a steady march. As soon as we figure out fire, well, then we figure out property and writing and whatever, all of the mm-hmm. accoutrements of modern civilization, where in fact it seems that people actually had fire a lot longer than that.
Oh.
And chose mm-hmm. not to come indoors. Like they had the tool, that this important tool that could be used for, you know, internal combustion engines or for inside a Franklin stove. But only since the Industrial Revolution have we like kind of really intensely tried to domesticate fire, just make fire work for us mm-hmm. in certain environments.
Mm-hmm.
The most obvious is inside the engine of your car, right? Like you're making a fire, tiny little explosion that's going to move that car down the road. But another would be the Franklin stove, right? That you have like the classic wood stove that we all have in our house, that you have a fire inside the stove.
Mm-hmm. And you have a hole that the smoke can go out.
Right, and a chimney and a hole and all that. Mm-hmm. So obviously people have been sleeping and eating and cooking around fires for way, way, way longer than that. And like I said, the natives of North America were using fire also to control the landscape and to build the soil. But up in let's say starting with 1900, the new American people, our people, started putting out forest fires, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't let forest fires burn. You don't have fire on the landscape. Fire is dangerous. Fire is wild. And we now see in the skies all across North America the results of that approach to fire, right? It's fires everywhere. Smoke in the air, because there's huge forest fires based resultant from like putting out forest fires for generations.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's clearly one of the moments in farming and in just general life management on Earth right now is humans have to recover their relationship with fire. Fire is one of the four elements. Fire is critical. Fire is like part of who we are. And certainly if you've spent any time like around a fire with your friends, you just, different kind of conversations are had mm-hmm. when you're around a fire. Mm-hmm. And we think of how we use fire in religious settings too, to burn incense, to like it, the smoke rises up to the sky, you see it, you feel it, you smell it, it does mm-hmm. something to your senses that is very, is beyond words mm-hmm. sort of, but mm-hmm. it's really profound. And so with this in mind, we on our place have like initiated some new like fire ideas. We've already talked to, lady from the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council, and she's going to come out and help us burn all of our areas that are like not in the woods but aren't accessible to the cows, so we can like start to reveal part of the landscape that is now like 10 feet tall with goldenrod. Nothing wrong with goldenrod, and supposedly it's not able to be removed just with fire, so we're going to have some other steps after that, but fire is a way of getting things going.
Well, that would be a great theme for Pasture Walk.
Yeah.
Is, you know, the use of fire, because a lot of us don't really know how to use it.
No, it's intimidating because it is so wild. You know,
it can get out of control really fast.
Certainly.
Yeah. A lot of us have had prairie fires.
Right. Yeah. But the other thing that, so that's one way of getting fire on the landscape, right? Where you get these benefits of, you know, organic matter quickly getting cycled to be usable by plants again.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And I hadn't really thought about that.
Yeah.
That it's really actually, how does it make it nutritious? I don't understand.
I don't totally understand the mechanism, but mm-hmm. like if you think about digestion and decomposition are basically mm-hmm. processes of carbonaceous matter being kind of broken down into its elements so they can be reused by other mm-hmm. life forms. Like you eat your food, it through action of your own body, but mainly through the actions of the microbes in your gut, it breaks down that food into components that then can be available to the mitochondria in your cells, who then provide your body with energy. And then a certain amount of it, you poop out, and then that all can be available to other kind of creatures. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's the process, and that takes the time it takes, you know?
Is that kind of what you call the carbon cycle?
Totally. I mean, the carbon cycle is such a critical part of understanding who we are and mm-hmm. what we are on this, mm-hmm. that the air, that we have this perfect symbiosis with plants, that what we breathe out, they breathe in, mm-hmm. and that they can make out of sunlight and CO2, they can make everything, you know? It's quite amazing.
It's pretty amazing. I'm going to take a little break and let you know that I'm talking with Lars Bergen, and you're listening to Digging Deep, which is our farming show here once a month on WDRT, WDRT.org, 91.9 FM, and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org. And we're coming out of Viroqua, Wisconsin, in this beautiful driftless area, which is already, I mean, nature made this a beautiful area to live in. And many people have moved here just for the beauty, Lars, right?
Yes.
Just for the beauty.
Just for the beauty.
Because it's just, you know, the land itself is just so beautiful, and a combination of balance of open and wooded and water, bodies of water and creeks and you know, hills. And it's a very beautiful place. So we're just kind of talking about use of the land. And I know that you want to, we've been talking about burning as, you know, kind of a theme, which we might want to continue at another time. But I know you have some other topics you want to talk about, Lars. So
sure enough. Well, burning, so the benefits of fire and especially the, you know, charred material, the black stuff mm-hmm. to your landscape. Like if you look at the residue of a fire, there's basically three components. There's the stuff that got went up in smoke or that got burned, which is not that relevant because it's gone for this purpose. There's the black stuff, which is just about pure carbon, and then there's the white stuff, which is minerals. And depending on how you let it burn, you know, if you smother the fire and don't give it much oxygen, you'll get a lot more black stuff, which otherwise would have gone up in smoke. Charcoal. And forever, people have used this technology of charcoal for a lot of different things. I would guess, I have no way of knowing this for sure, but I would guess that charcoal was maybe our first drawing and writing material.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, mm-hmm. it's bold, it's black, you can mm-hmm. make it different shapes and sizes.
Mm-hmm.
So it was certainly one of humanity's first fuels. You know, you can, like, cooking with charcoal, everyone's done it. It's like cooking with wood, but it lasts, burns cleaner, and it burns longer. Because what's in, and the process of making charcoal is basically you heat the wood in the absence of oxygen. And then as you heat it, it lets go of what are called the VOCs, volatile organic chemicals, which are flammable gases. If anyone has like a modern wood stove, you can see this along the top of your stove. Like once you get a nice fire going and then you damper it down, you'll see these blue flames along the top. That's the combustion of the VOCs. Those are the wood gases being given off and then being burned along the top of the stove. If you design a machine or a system to make charcoal specifically, the ways you can do it is you can get a nice hot fire going and then just quench it. And that'll
How do you do that?
Water. Or smother it.
Or smother like, it with like with
dirt
soil.
Or whatever. And that's the way traditionally people did it back in the bush. You'd like dig a hole, make a fire in it, and then somehow smother that fire so it can just smolder and get rid of those gases, but you're not going to burn mm-hmm. off all the carbon. Mm-hmm. Well, in recent years, and then fast forward to the Amazon, where people, it has been proven, were using charcoal to build the soil, because in a rainforest type situation, almost all the fertility, all the nutrients, everything is in the trees, in the canopy of the forest.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to build the soil, you need to like somehow add to it. You don't have the sun and the grass and the cows and all that doing what they would do in open ground. So they would smolder wood, make charcoal, and then mix it with broken pottery into the soil to create a much more like porous, richer, more productive soil. And you can go to the Amazon today and find these soil mixes that were made 1,000 years ago that are still wonderfully productive, because in charring the wood, you make it much more resilient to change. You keep the carbon in the system so that you kind of open up its pore space, but you also kind of lignify it almost, make it a little bit more minerally and less like alive. And but that allows it to be kind of a permanent reservoir in your soil of fertility that'll hold nutrients in it, hold nitrogen in it until your plants need it. And also in the moment right now when a lot of people think we need to like take carbon out of the air, greenhouse gases, this is a great way of doing that, because instead of the wood decomposing in a mulch pile or burning off in a fire, it's turned into this char product and then it stays in the soil. And so in the past 18 months or so, a couple of friends of mine, we have developed a machine for making biochar,
mm-hmm.
which is basically charred wood that is this then ground fine. And I've actually brought you a bag of it so you can take it home and try it on your houseplants and wherever you like.
Oh,
this
wow.
is for you. Look.
Okay, so it's ground. It's fine.
It's ground fine, right? Because you want to be able to mix it into uh-huh. your soil or into your potted mm-hmm. plants. There's instructions on the back about how to use it. But basically, you want to at least soak it with water before you use it. But even better, soak it with a fertilizer water mixture, because it has, it's pure carbon. There's no nitrogen in it. There's very little like food for your plants, but it's a great reservoir for the food for your plants. So before you put it around your tomatoes or mix it in your houseplants, ideally you just whatever like fish emulsion or whatever liquid fertilizer you have available, just mix, let it soak in that for a couple of days and then put it out there. And yeah, for those of us, though, you on the radio, we are, this stuff is for sale at Nelson's and at the co-op. So if you're interested.
Mm-hmm. So you're not making, are you making and selling larger pieces of charcoal? Or are you doing all this?
We've done a little bit of that, but there's a tremendous demand for, I mean, the fact is there's good suppliers of charcoal already, but mm-hmm. there's not people really doing this already. So, mm-hmm. but we are selling the biochar in bigger lots, like 2 yard super sacks, or in these little bags for people that, mm-hmm. you know, more on a household basis, because right. farmers are interested right. in applying it to their land for all these benefits, moisture retention, you know, nutrient retention, mm-hmm. It helps with compaction. And actually it's one of those ancient technologies that humans are just starting to figure out again. So a lot of it's what it'll do, we don't really know, but, we'll be applying it to about 20-30 acres of our valley and hill ground mm-hmm. this year for the next 3 years with the help of the NRCS, the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Mm-hmm. So we'll know a lot more about it soon. But it's again, if people want the benefits of fire on their landscape but don't have the capacity or the interest in burning themselves, this is a way of getting it out there. You can buy it in a bag.
Well, I'm just kind of thinking, well, don't we use charcoal to cook our meat?
Right, and that'd be where you're using it.
Wouldn't that be?
Yeah.
Yeah, but your nice little segue over to recipes.
Totally. So back all the way around to our show that we did last time is like, if you're farming or hunting, or like herding versus hunting, beef versus venison. Like, what are the differences? You know, you have... obviously, a beef cow is much bigger than even the biggest buck. So that's one clear difference, is like that if you butcher a cow or you buy a cow, like you're getting a lot more meat than you're getting from a deer. But the I'm going to talk a little bit about the cuts and the quality of them on the different two animals. So like on any four-footed herbivore, like your most tender meat is your primals, right? Your muscles right along the spine on both sides. And that's where you get your New York strips and ribeyes from your cow, and that's where you get your venison loin from. And that's going to be pretty similar. I would say the way we do our venison, we hang it for 4, 5, 6 days before we cut it, mm-hmm. depending on the weather. But and I would say that in general, the venison meat is a little more tender than beef, but it's a lot drier. You know, it doesn't have fat in it. So mm-hmm. so a lot of people that have had bad experiences eating venison, that venison was overcooked or mm-hmm. cooked too fast or cooked without fat.
That's why grass-fed beef has to be cooked differently from a corn-fed, you know, marbled beef, you know.
Right. And I think properly raised grass-fed beef can have nearly as much marbling in it. Beef put on fat more than, and their fat is different than the deer fat. Anyway, it works. Beef, well-finished beef, grass-fed or corn-fed, is going to have marbling in the meat, mm-hmm. but to some extent. Really, venison won't. So you have to work with that as a cook. Mm-hmm. But it's super tender. So these are the two things, mm-hmm. the back, the hindquarters and the back straps are going to be nice and tender. So the ways that we work with that is like to eat a fair amount of our venison raw in the form of sushi. But you could also do something kind of like a ceviche, which I've mm-hmm. done before too, where you basically like soak it in lime juice to like cook it without heating it. In so doing, you kind of take away whatever like gamey flavor there is, but there shouldn't be much anyway. and then just give it a, it's a even more tender, like mm-hmm. mouth chew.
Isn't that what you're kind of doing when with a marinade?
Yes.
Yeah. You're sort of pre-cooking it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And but in this case, then you just never cook it, just like because mm-hmm. because it is so dry. The other way that we like to eat it is in stroganoff, which is a creamy sauce. Like, I don't know if you've ever had stroganoff. It's
yes.
It's so good. It's a mushroom cream onion sauce. And that
then, is there a little tomato or not?
I don't use tomato in mine. I've heard of people using tomato paste, but not like tomato chunks. Mm-hmm. And then so if I'm telling this on a cooking show, you start by like browning your onions, throwing your mushrooms in there, getting them cooked, putting something to deglaze it in there. I usually use white wine, could use a little vinegar, whatever, to get the brown off the pan. Add a bunch of sour cream and thyme, and then some salt, and then taste it. You're like, that's delicious. And then you cook it, turn it down so it's just simmering, and then you put your chopped up venison meat in there and cook it in the sauce.
The uncooked meat.
Yes.
Okay.
And that way it's cooked in fat the whole time.
Okay.
So it never, and it'll release a little moisture in that process, but if you go nice and slow and keep a simmer on there, you'll eventually really get delicious and wonderful, and then just taste it and eat it. So that's, so, and I think I've done cream coconut curries the same way, but the basic principle is I think when you cook venison, you either need to cook it pretty rare or raw, or you need to cook it in a fatty sauce of some kind, you know, and I imagine you could probably make some pretty delicious, like, deep-fried venison nuggets, too, or something. I've never done that, but, like, just, it doesn't seem to do, you don't want to dry it out. So, and we do grind some of our venison. The front quarter is pretty tough, got a lot of fascia, so if we're going to eat that ourselves, we'll grind it. Otherwise, we'll just cut it up for animal feed or pet food. Dogs mainly.
So do you mix it with something else when you grind it? Do you have some other
if you're gonna make
fattier
like
meat with it?
Yeah, like there's a tradition in my family kept alive by Vincent Don of making this venison sausage, which is more or less half pork and half beef. Mm-hmm. And the pork is that's what contributes the kind of fat to it, and then the venison contributes the red meat part of it, and that's really a great way to eat it. And then with beef, obviously people are much more familiar with how to cook beef and how it, but what I've found is that with beef there's a lot of benefits to cooking it twice. If you are cooking beef, has a lot of water in it, and like you can do things to keep that water in there, which is like by salting it heavily ahead of time and then cooking it fairly rare, in the case of like a steak or something. But there's also something I picked up in a Chinese cookbook called dry frying, which is basically when you're making a stir fry, or you cut the meat in little bits, you stir fry it, but you stir fry it, it'll release all these juices, and then you cook the juices back in, hence dry frying. Like you take it all the way back to dry, like so that the instead of like you usually when I've been taught to brown meat, the idea is that you're getting the oil nice and hot, you're putting the meat in there, and then you're getting a brown crust on it to keep the juices in. This is sort of the opposite way of browning meat, where you're like cooking the juices out, but then cooking them back in, almost the way you would cook mushrooms. And it winds up being just very delicious and very tender and super easy to work with in making like a stir fry or something, because all the liquid's out of it. So it doesn't suddenly like release all this liquid and make your sauce really runny. Because, so, are you following?
I don't understand where the juice comes from if you cook it all out. Explain that to me.
Well, you'll it's the juice goes back in. It boils off. The water boils off, and then whatever is like the flavored part of that goes back into the meat, and it just leaves you. And then it'll brown in the wok or in the pan at the end of the process, not at the beginning, if you follow.
I know I've been taught to do that with mushrooms.
Yeah, it's the same as mushrooms. It's like you just, instead of trying to like be really careful to keep that liquid in there, you let it go out and basically become your cooking liquid, and then it goes back into the food. And so you've all the nutrients you get, you're just basically kind of managing the water, because like there's a lot of water in protein.
So when do you salt? You salt at the beginning?
A little at the beginning, and then for taste at the end, you know? Okay. Like, but if you wanted, if you're salting for like moisture retention and tenderizing, then you do it, you know, hours before you're going to cook, and like let it kind of soak in, marinate, brine, whatever you want to call that term.
Right.
And I think that dry frying is a new method to my world, and it's been really helpful to being, then you're really, you can use almost any cut of meat and get pretty good results.
I think I've been doing that with my lamb and I didn't even know it.
Yeah.
But I just have little tiny chunks of lamb, the way Anton butchered the meat, a very young lamb. And I called it stew, but it's not stew. It's really tender.
Nice.
And it takes about 3 minutes.
Cool.
To cook these little pieces. And yeah, they're kind of juicy at first, and then they kind of dry up.
Yeah.
And they're really tender.
Yeah. Yeah, if done right, it seems like you'd be drying it out and toughening it up, but it's not.
Really.
It's not. You know, you do want it for this method. You want fairly small pieces. But I've also found in general, small pieces of meat are better. They take flavor more. They're not going to choke you to death. And it's way more forgiving of what cut you're using, because if you cut it small enough, it's all chewable. You know, it's
right. It is all chewable. And hey, you know, something that I learned, sort of related to this, we had two steers. Well, we shouldn't say we had two steers. We had a steer and we had a bull. We had never castrated the one. And so we had them butchered at the same time. And the steer had much more marbling.
Yeah.
And they had all eaten the same food. They were all grass-fed. But I realized, that's why you castrate them.
All that energy that would be going into the reproductive system is instead going into their meat.
Yeah, and so, you know, there was much more marbling on
testosterone, the steer. I mean, the reason that people take testosterone to build their muscle is obviously that, like, it makes your muscles, like, hard and strong, you know? Like, and certainly, when you castrate's an interesting question we do calving to finishing. So we have the calf on the farm and then keep it until it's ready to butcher. And a lot of people castrate like right away because it's easier to catch them and they're littler.
Yeah.
But then those calves don't grow as well because they don't have the testosterone, which is a major growth hormone. If you go too long, then you have an animal that's like a little bit hard to handle. And also it's a little bit more traumatic and hazardous to do the castrating because if you're cutting them, it's a much bigger wound, or if it's if you're banding them, it takes longer to drop off and all that. So, we usually go like 4 to 6 months. Get past that, and you start to cause new problems. If you go before that, then they just don't grow as well.
But I was thinking that you're never castrating animals that are out in the woods.
No, and it's so funny.
So they'd just be, you know, males. They're just wild.
And I've not found, I've shot some nice big bucks over the years, and they seem just as tender as everything else. So,
But they're drier.
Yes.
They don't have as much fat.
Totally.
So, that was just kind of one thing we noticed.
And the time in the year when we hunt is kind of at the end of the rut, you know, at the end of their breeding period. So that the
What time is that?
November. Okay. You know, like the rut is usually at, you know, mid-September through Thanksgiving or so.
Okay.
So the bucks tend to be a lot lower in fat in general than the does, because the does are adding fat so that they can support a fetus through the winter, mm-hmm. whereas the bucks are spending their energy in like fighting and breeding and all that. So mm-hmm. they tend to be have a lot less like fat on their backs, less tallow. Right. Or
yeah, and that's another thing you don't have when you're raising your beef. They're not fighting with each other. I mean, that's a whole different environment, right?
Right. Well, that's the other reason you castrate, of course, yeah. is that you only want one. If you have two bulls in there, they surely will and can fight
yeah,
with each other.
Right, right. But, you wouldn't want that. Yeah. Yeah. So it's just interesting thinking about all those things, though, you know?
Right. And to me, it's like the themes that I really feel like we try and work with on our land, and both in our farming, our eating, and our land management is just like, man, that God put us here on earth with abundance, and like, how do we spend more time like appreciating and managing like the incredible mm. resources that are here than killing and fencing and like trying to control it?
Mm-hmm.
Like the control trip is a tough one for all of us, you know, like the more we can let things happen that are meant to happen, unless mm-hmm. we can fight it. So that's why, like, to me, doing some controlled burns instead of brush hogging all the time seems like you're working with a natural process instead of starting your tractor again.
Well, that's a very interesting idea. Maybe we should burn our thistles. I don't know if you get rid of thistles seeds, though, by burning. Do you get rid of seeds?
Oh, yeah, I mean,
survive the burn?
No, I think the seeds will burn. I think where if it's Canadian thistles, what you wouldn't impact as much is they cast a seed, but they also have an underground network. They spread by rhizomes, too, and that may not get it. But I don't know. It's all these – I got a scythe this year, which is a fun tool, like where, again, like there's a lot of places you can't get to with a tractor or – you know, the tractor causes its own damage. Like, for example, I used to have a terrible thistle patch on one of my pastures. Just really didn't even want to walk mm-hmm. through there. And I religiously mowed it and mowed it. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't seem to go away.
Yeah.
And then I gave up and just let it go. And within 2 years, natural competition and cows and everything, and there's still thistles in there, but it's nothing like it was. Or you look along all the roads where they've been mowing all the time, and it's nothing but parsnip. And they're mowing to prevent the parsnip, but the parsnip just seems to love being mowed.
Hey, let's talk about parsnip. I mean, is there a natural way of managing parsnip? I mean, it has really gotten out of control. And so you're saying, well, maybe I was thinking maybe mowing at the wrong time. I mean, you can't mow it after it's got seeds on it, or you're just going to have... you know, just going to re-sow more.
Right, and also it's, you know, obviously the sap it'll burn your skin, so mowing it seems not indicated for that reason, too, if you don't want to splatter it on yourself. So, again, I found that our patches, most of the parsnip patches that we have on our place, natural succession took care of it.
Mm.
You know, and the cows will eat it if it's young enough.
Mm-hmm.
So, and supposedly the roots are edible too. So you could also, I mean, if you just have a couple, just dig them out and eat them in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. The only two plants that we have, that we are actively managing against right now in our place are, multiflora rose, because that's it. They grow under the fences and they grow wild, and they really are, they're very, 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 they'll cut you up and it's hard to work around them. So we're mm-hmm. trying to keep that under control. And mm-hmm. then goldenrod, it just has done extremely well, and so well that the cows won't eat it. So like it kind mm-hmm. of grows on its own. So we obviously have gardens too. And, especially my wife Karina, she's a really good weeder, and if you want to have a garden, you're going to have to pull some weeds. You know, like there's no two ways about it. So, but that's, you know, for us, that's 1 acre of the 115 that you're concerned about those particular plants getting in there. Mm-hmm. But generally, I think you have to be willing to accept that a plant is doing its job by being a plant, and that like the only really thing to worry about is bare dirt. If you have a part of your farm that won't grow anything and won't even grow weeds, that's a problem. That's not right. That's not normal. That's like nature wants to cover bare ground. So maintaining bare ground for any reason is not a good approach, you know, like and that's what's such a challenge with like row crop farming, is that you're basically maintaining bare ground to the benefit of one species, and that's not over time. That's just going to take a lot of effort and a lot of digging and a lot of it's never been my strong suit. We tried with row crops a little bit in our place, and we just found that the erosion and the extra work was certainly not worth it. So I think, yeah, that, and we've been on there 20 years now, and I think a huge part of this pursuing beauty is going slow and being patient, really knowing your land before you start like putting in fences or moving dirt. Like, learn it, because it will help you know. It'll tell you. Like, we've put in a couple ponds the last couple of years, and those ponds have been so generative. They've brought so much life onto the farm, so much beauty. And because we put them in the right spots, we watched where was a wet spot, where was a spot that was almost always wet, and worked with what nature was presenting to us. We didn't, rather than saying, well, we want a pond in this spot, and so we're just gonna like dig and dig and dig until there's a pond, you know, like we started with spots that already had a seep, and then worked from there. And so, again, these are just ideas. These are just principles. Like, every person has a different mindset and a slightly different eye of what for beauty. But I think it, the heart of it is asking yourself what you think is beautiful. Like, what brought me here? Why am I here? And then you're, you can't make a mistake. You can't go wrong. Just as like there's not herding and hunting. One is not superior to the other. There are different ways of feeding yourself, feeding other people, and they're both fine, you know. But I think one is not morally or ecologically superior to the other. They're both fine. But like, it's good to recognize differences, and the differences in what kind of person does well with each thing. Some people just really, really need long stretches of solitude in the woods to be well, to be happy. Those are hunters. Some people really need a process and a routine and a rhythm to be happy. Those are herdsmen. Some of us are both. I consider myself to be both. But but then you look at, so that's some people really, really love like a kind of order, and those people should have a smaller garden that they can really keep in order.
I'm getting smaller and smaller. it's a lot of work. And I just can't believe, you know, you go out a week later and you say, didn't I already weed this?
Right, and you have to eat it all too.
I know, and I don't need that much food anymore. I mean, I really just, I have a few tomato plants and I have a few onions and, you know, garlic. I like variety, and I like having, you know, salads and herbs, but I like to have flowers in the garden. My garden probably looks pretty messy to some people, but it's more like an English garden with this, that, and the other thing growing in.
Yeah, ours
and
too.
And reseeding. It just reseeds itself.
And we did something different the last couple of years. Our neighbor is Hidden Springs Farm, a very excellent and successful sheep dairy. And they need to shear their sheep for the health of the sheep, but they don't like market or clean up the wool. So I got some bags of wool.
Oh, speak about that a little bit.
And we used it for mulch, and it is quite an interesting mulch.
Why? And how do you use it? How thick do you put it on?
Pretty thick, like 6 inches probably to start. It compresses a little bit, but you need to put something under it, like cardboard or whatever, to suppress the weeds. But mulch does a lot of different things, right? It suppresses weeds. It controls the temperature of the soil. It's amazing for that, because obviously the same reason that it's a great insulator as a sweater. It's a great insulator of the soil. So it keeps the soil nice and cool. And also as a way of conserving moisture in the soil, it's fantastic. It doesn't get ever seemingly like soaking wet itself, but it'll keep that soil mm-hmm. below it cool mm-hmm. and moist.
Oh, very interesting.
And it's the final thing that mulch does in its life cycle is to provide fertility and nutrition for the soil. And that supposedly it's got like more nitrogen than like any of our carbon-based mulches, like wood mulch or straw. It's almost, those are mainly mm-hmm. carbon. Whereas it has, so it's actually feeding the soil more as it breaks down than normal mulches. And this is year two, and you certainly, you know, if you don't have that layer underneath it of cardboard or feed bags or newspaper or something, weeds will go through it, and then that's kind of a pain in the neck because you have to disentangle it from all the weeds.
I've discovered using paper, mm-hmm. just garden paper.
Yeah.
And it's not cardboard, but you can just roll it out, and then you put your mulch on top and really suppresses the weeds, slows down the weeds quite a bit.
Right, and obviously paper is just wood pulp, so it's
just,
it's a good,
in a couple of years it just disintegrates. And
yeah,
I'm so glad I used to use that plastic path type stuff, and that's awful.
We tried it different times too, but it just doesn't. Mm-hmm. Eventually it's something that has to go to the landfill.
Well, I'm really worried about agricultural plastic. You just drive along the road, and I guess it's mostly it's not, well, hay, I guess they're wrapping the hay in plastic, but it's a lot of it is, what is the other stuff? I mean,
row cover?
No, that you feed your animals in the winter.
Silage.
Silage is wrapped up in plastic, too.
Well,
right?
Yeah, I mean, it's called haylage or balage.
Okay, so what I'm thinking is that we need to think of something that will protect the hay for a while, for a year.
Mm-hmm.
But really is truly biodegradable. And I have thought about something to do with wool, but we need something that a machine can come out and cover the hay or the silage or haylage with something that is just really, truly biodegradable. Because they've tried to recycle this plastic, and it's awful. It's filthy. It's covered with manure. The animals have tromped on it. No one wants to recycle that plastic. There have been businesses that tried to do it, and they don't like. So I think maybe we need to find something that just disintegrates in the fields. Anybody invent that? And they could probably make a million, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's different. I think what you're saying about ag plastic is correct. It's not really recyclable. For my job, I sell recycling machines, and we did a couple of demos of trying to grind it to prepare it for recycling, and it didn't work, and it was really dirty and stinky. So I think what they're doing with wrapping the bales is it's got to be an airtight seal, right? That's, they're trying to ferment it. You know, like it's a basically
so
much
airtight. Okay.
Yeah, a different way of making hay. You know, like most throughout history, most of people have made their hay by like cutting it, letting it dry, and then, it's stable because it's dry. And then, but then you do have to keep it inside or keep it under a roof somehow.
Mm-hmm.
The idea behind, silage or balage is that you're making it higher moisture, and then you're sealing it up and fermenting it.
And fermenting it, yeah. Which
and so,
be, yeah.
You know, I can see, especially with the rainier weather we've been getting, it gets harder and harder to make good dry hay. And so a lot of guys have gone to wrapping their bales and fermenting them. And it does make wonderful feed, but you do have this added expense of the plastic and then the byproduct of the plastic. And
yeah,
so,
right.
So one potential solution would be if you kind of like made like a, take some concrete or like make a tunnel that you could cover that would be airtight on the sides, and then you just, at least even if you covered it with plastic, you're only using less plastic by covering it tight.
Yeah.
So I don't know. You would think that, yeah, that someone should be working on that. I imagine there are people. A biodegradable bale wrapper would be a wonderful thing.
Wouldn't that be great? Well, I just always love talking with you, Lars. You really stimulate me, and I'm sure many, many listeners to just think, and I hope that my listeners are getting something out of learning about, where food comes from. And there's just so many, well, it comes from the land. It comes from these four elements, as you say. So thanks so much for tuning in, and We will see you next week on Who's in the Kitchen.